You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Law and order have broken down in Detroit, Michigan.
We looked down 12th Street, and all you seen was fire and smoke.
Oh, the Motor City is burning.
Those shots are being fired on 12th Street.
Chaos. Chaos. Just everywhere. People everywhere.
I said, this can't be happening to my city.
The madness overtook everything.
Anything in the world that Johnny can do.
To understand just why African-American Detroiters hit a boiling point with the city's police force that hot week in July 1967, we must turn to history. The history of the DPD, how it began, how white police officers treated black men, women, and children in Detroit through the decades. Jamon Jordan is an historian and a tour leader for Black Scroll Network History and Tours. We recently sat down to talk at the Detroit Historical Museum.
Well, certainly, Jamon, historians have been exceptionally clear. We talked to Thomas Sugrue, among others.
Oh, yes, good, good.
One of the central causes of the Rebellion of 67 was this very long, tense, and unresolved history of conflict between Detroit's overwhelmingly white Detroit police force and its African-American population. But let's start right there in 67. Tell us, what was it like to be black and be on streets patrolled by the mostly all-white DPD?
The reality of it is that African-Americans in Detroit and white Detroiters were living in two different worlds when it came to the way that the police were oriented towards them. The police department was about 95% white in a city that was becoming about 40% African-American. And for years, this had been a problem. There were so many complaints about racist brutality and harassment and, of course, some shootings of African-Americans who were unarmed. And so most African-Americans at that time felt that the police department was really like an occupying force, an occupying army, that you had to do what they said. So if you look back at American history, when the British troops were in in the 13 colonies, and how the colonists felt when the British troops told them to do something, and the colonists had no say-so in British government policy, but these redcoats, these British troops were telling them what to do, and eventually, of course, they caused a rebellion, which became the American Revolution. This is how many African-American Detroiters were feeling in 1967.
Let's talk about how far back this has been going on, even the very origins of the Detroit Police Department. What do we know about its roots and the men who joined the department and who became Detroit's police officers right from the beginning?
So if we go back to the beginning of Detroit Police Department, so in the 1830s, when Detroit was still a territory, you had a sheriff and a deputy. You didn't have a city police force yet. But because Detroit was such a hotbed of activity in the abolitionist movement in the Underground Railroad, the city council would create a 16-man patrol. Their job would be to enforce certain kinds of codes against Negroes and mulattoes at that time, which, of course, it was trying to stem the abolitionist movement, trying to stop African-Americans and others who were abolitionists from participating in Underground Railroad activity. And then 30 years later, after the 1863 race riot, which occurred during the Civil War, the 16-man patrol would be evolved and become an official Detroit Police Department.
And I think a lot of people forget mm-hmm. that there was trouble in 1863,
That's
big
right.
trouble.
Yes. Well,
give us a nutshell explanation of that.
Yeah, so in 1863, you had, in the middle of the Civil War, you had people who were pro-Confederate in Detroit. And one of the most powerful organs in Detroit was the Michigan Intelligencer and Democratic Free Press, which, of course, was a Democratic newspaper. Today, it is simply the Detroit Free Press. And the Democrats at that time were pro-Confederate. When Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, the newspaper goes livid and begins to write numerous articles attacking Lincoln. And then an African-American saloon owner named William Faulkner is arrested for molesting a 9-year-old white girl and an 11-year-old African-American girl. And the newspaper, of course, blames Lincoln. They blame the Civil War, and they blame the Emancipation Proclamation for all of this. And it turns out that the girls were paid to tell this story, but no one knew that at the time. And the newspaper really kind of engaged the community, particularly people who had racist feelings, to go and try to kill William Faulkner. They were unable to do that, and so the first race riot occurred. They attacked random African-Americans, killing one beating him to death, and then maiming and injuring dozens of others and burning down 30 buildings. And that's the first true race riot. People talk about 1967 as a race riot. In 1967 was not a race riot, but 1863 was the first race riot. And Detroit, of course, had another great race riot in 1943.
Yes, in fact, let's go up there. And in that less than a century between 1863 and that race riot of 1843, How were relations between the African-American community and the police?
In 1925, 55 African-Americans were shot by Detroit police officers. They weren't all killed, but they were shot by Detroit police officers. You could have had a Black Lives Matter movement in Detroit in 1925. And the continuation of bad relationships and harassment and brutality and, of course, unarmed African-Americans being shot continued through the 1930s and 1940s. When we get to 1943, that was a true race riot. There were people being attacked simply because of their race. And you had 34 people killed in that race riot, 25 African-Americans and 9 whites. And out of those 25 African-Americans who were killed, 17 of them were killed by the Detroit Police Department. No whites were killed by the Detroit Police Department in the 1943 race riot.
That was an ugly time. We had so many Southerners come up for jobs in the factories. So you had black Southerners and white Southerners. And then a lot of people forget that there was nearly a full-blown riot in 66 on Kercheval.
That's right. And, of course, that was definitely involving the police.
What happened?
You had a group of young men led by an activist on the east side named Will McClendon and his organization, the Afro-American Youth Movement. And their idea was to resist the treatment by the racist police department, particularly the Big Four. And the Big Four were known to go drive down the street. It would be four officers in an unmarked black patrol car. And they would come on the corner and say, give me that corner. And then, of course, African-American, particularly young African-American men or boys, would have to get off of that corner. And so this is what happens. So the Big Four tells them to move. They refuse. The Big Four get out of the car, of course, going to do what they normally do, and that's assault young African-American males for refusing to move immediately when they tell them to do something. And a group of other African-American males joins the group on the corner. And so now the Big Four are outnumbered. And so the Big Four call for backup, and a special unit who was already downtown because of the Vietnam War protests comes. There are community leaders who are trying to get the youth to get off the corner and stop confronting the police, and then a storm comes. And so it's a big rainstorm. So that stops the 1966 rebellion, because it probably would have been one had it not been for all of these things coming together. The police were at full strength. It was a storm.
Black community leaders came out
immediately. So all of those things worked together to kind of squash the 1966 rebellion on Kercheval on the east side. But, of course, those problems didn't come all together. Those issues didn't all come together on behalf of the authorities in 1967.
And then we had that week. And afterward, it wasn't as if things got better, and I only have to say stress unit and Malice Green. So let's talk about, because that takes us through some years. Talk about stress.
So stress was Stop the Robberies and Joy Safe Streets. And, of course, that was an initiative started in the early 1970s by the Detroit Police Department. Many people will argue that what it was it was kind of a revenge for the rebellion and for the activist organizations that were in the city of Detroit. There were a number of radical activist organizations. You had the West Central Organization, probably one of the most well-organized of the radical organizations in the city of Detroit, kind of near Southwest Detroit. But then, of course, you also had the Republic of New Africa, which was raided in 1969, and two officers get shot by members of the RNA at New Bethel Baptist Church. And one of those officers, of course, becomes one of the first recruits for stress. And, of course, he shoots 8 people during his time of stress. And so you can connect the dots easily. Here's an officer who was shot by a radical African-American organization, the RNA. He joins stress and shoots 8 young African-Americans in his time with stress. So stress didn't make any bones about their really being enemies of the African-American community. And so Coleman Young, when he runs for office and using stress as part of his platform of removing, getting rid of stress, that was a powerful message to the African American community who all knew that stress was a problem in the African American community.
And indeed, it was Coleman Young who got elected and
got rid of
stress. Rid of stress.
That's right.
Jamon, as we're talking about these years, the 60s with the Big Four, stress in the 70s, were women treated differently than men?
So Detroit police in general had a horrible relationship with African Americans in general, and that included women. In 1963, in July of 1963, you have Theodore Spiker, an officer patrolling the area that we now call Brush Park or Midtown, and he, of course, confronts Cynthia Scott. Cynthia Scott, before that night is over, is shot three times, two times in the back and once in the head by the officer Spiker. And according to him, he was about to arrest her for prostitution, and she lashed out at him with a knife, and he was defending himself. But this rolling of African-American women who were involved in sex trafficking or prostitution was a well-known tradition of police officers as well. And rolling prostitutes means taking their money and, of course, threatening them with jail if they say something. So it's believed by many people in the African-American community that that's what happened with Cynthia Scott, and she resisted. She didn't want to give up her money, and she ended up dead.
We heard from former Detroit Police Chief Ike McKinnon earlier this week about the horrendous reception he got on his first day as a Detroit police officer in 1966. He walked in, and he was the only black face in the room. Mm-hmm. A high school classmate who wound up being assigned to him flung the racial epithet at him, mm-hmm. would not speak to him, and few people, I think, would fault him for saying, "I'm done," but he and others persisted. Mm-hmm. At what point did the shift begin to happen where we saw enough faces of color in the ranks of the DPD to start moving the needle?
Really, that's one of the major contributions to the city of Detroit by Mayor Coleman Young. Mayor Coleman Young, of course, was elected in the 1973 election and takes office in 74. And within that 20 years of his mayoralty, he transformed the Detroit Police Department. Of course, we had a residency law at that time, so that helped some. And, of course, Coleman Young was a strong proponent of affirmative action and believed that African Americans needed to be representative in the population of the police department as they are in the population of the city. And so more than any one thing, Coleman Young's successive terms helped to transform the Detroit Police Department.
To that mm-hmm. point, let's talk about 1992 and the death of motorist Malice Green. Two white Detroit officers, Walter Budson and Larry Nevers, were eventually convicted of second-degree murder of beating Green to death with a mag flashlight, 14 blunt force trauma blows to the head, according to the coroner's report. Two decorated white officers with a history of excessive force complaints. Did their convictions send a message to white officers? Did that begin to change then? Was that a watershed point?
That is a watershed point. So for a couple of reasons. Number one, the prosecutor did not bite her tongue about what they had done, that they had murdered a young African-American man, and that this killing was unjust. And it was argued in court that way. And Coleman Young made a clear statement that what this was unjust killing by these two police officers who were notorious for brutality against African-American citizens.
Well, we've got Chief James Craig, one of a line of black police chiefs. We have had black mayors. So as we talk now in 2017, what's working better than 50 years ago?
So, of course, relationships with the Detroit Police Department ought to be beyond law enforcement. So they need to be considered or do the best they can to entrench themselves as part of the community. And so people see them in other ways than arresting people and pulling people over and taking people to jail and putting people in handcuffs and shooting at people. People need to see the police in other ways.
Are they?
And the police department is doing some of that. I don't think enough, but more than they were doing in 67. So that's helpful. As long as they're doing that, they need to up the ante on that. That needs to be done more than it's being done right now. And that would help to kind of clear some of the relationship between members of the Detroit Police Department and the African-American community. I know all the Detroit Police Department aren't trigger-happy people who are ready to shoot somebody at the drop of a dime. I know that that's not the case. But we need more of them to be involved in community activities, community events. We need to see them more as parts of our community, the same as we see the people who are running our schools and teachers. We see them as part of the community. We need to see our police department and police officers as part of the community.
There are so many terms people use to describe what happened 50 years ago. You hear riot, you hear uprising, you hear rebellion. What term do you use?
I use the term rebellion.
Why?
And I use the term rebellion because, of course, I don't focus on just those 5 days. If you focus on those 5 days and that's it, then, of course, it's a riot. It meets all the definition of a riot. But I focus on the 5 decades prior to that, to 1967. And if you look at the 5 decades of history, you know that these kinds of events are going to eventually come to a head, and there's going to be a response from the community. And so housing discrimination, educational inequality, police brutality, employment discrimination, eventually people are going to respond, and they responded in a rebellion.
Did the city, did the police department learn lessons from 1967?
So it took them a while because, as we know, in the 1970s, they started stress. And so some of the lessons they learned at first was to become even more repressive. But as time goes on, some police departments begin to take this to heart. Now, we know that the president, Lyndon Johnson, had a commission created, the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, known as the Kerner Commission, named after Governor Otto Kerner, who was the chairman of the commission. And they studied these uprisings throughout the cities in America that were happening in the 1960s, and, of course, Detroit being one of the most significant ones. And they came up with a number of proposals, but, of course, the overall statement was that we're moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. And they began to talk about how police departments needed to change and how the news media needed to change and how the school systems needed to change. And President Lyndon Johnson refused to even read the commission. After he brought this group together, they did all of this work, they did all this research, and then came up with this report, he refused to even listen to it because, of course, he was knee-deep into Vietnam at that time and didn't want this to begin to sully his moving forward in the Vietnam War. And just as he didn't deal with it, many mayors, governors, and even police departments didn't deal with it either. So it took a while even for the city of Detroit to get the message of what was going on in the city of Detroit. And more activists had to get involved, had to protest, had to get arrested, and had to become part of the system in cases, become part of the police department, become judges, become prosecutors. As the community got involved in all of these areas, both outside of the system and within the system, that helped to change the Detroit Police Department.
Jamon Jordan, tour leader for Black Scroll Network History and Tours. It was great to talk with you. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.